For the week of August 22nd, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 68, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, on my deathbed, I'm Michael Giltz.
Aw.
I thought I was on my deathbed.
I'm the only one healthy.
Yeah, you're the only one healthy. I'm sick. Michael, you're sick. And that's actually the reason we don't have a special guest today. And
we don't want to make them sick.
We didn't want to be, right. And we thought, you know, Skype is really good. It's really clear at times. So we thought maybe it could.
I was going to say, nobody cares if you get me sick, but no.
It's only the guests we're worried about.
Only the guests we care about.
Yeah. And when I'm this sick, I can't make a joke. I can barely make a joke when I'm not sick. So
okay, you were really funny last week.
Okay, funny looking maybe. Well, I do take responsibility for not booking a guest this week. I was a little under the weather and I did not have time to book the show as I recuperated. Even so, we still have plenty of entertainment news to tell you about, even during the dog days of summer, when more often than not, little happens in the business we call show. We have some pretty juicy news. Patrick Goldstein of the LA Times debates Jennifer Aniston's status as a movie star, and we'll talk about that story. The Facebook movie is creating all sorts of Oscar buzz and still has 6 weeks to go before it's even released. We'll check in on Lil Wayne in prison and find out how his time in the big house has affected his earnings. And of course, we'll run through all the top entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop before discussing the rising fortunes of a Hollywood trade paper during Inside Baseball. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on this past weekend's box office.
Well, it was a quiet weekend because it's August, of course, but the number one movie at the box office was The Expendables with $16.5 million. That's $64 million and counting for Sylvester Stallone's latest film and his biggest hit since Cliffhanger. At number two was a spoof of the Twilight films called Vampires Suck, which, like Sperling, I didn't even know was being released. That came out on Wednesday. Over the weekend, it grossed $12 million, and its total is $18 million so far, and it only cost $20 million to make. And number three is the Julia Roberts film, Eat, Pray, Love, which dropped pretty heavily for a chick flick. It grossed $12 million and is at $47 million total, but it should probably do very well overseas since half the film was set overseas. And number four is the urban comedy Lottery Ticket with Ice Cube and Bow Wow that grossed $11 million and will do great on video. At number five is The Other Guys, which grossed another $10 million. The Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg comedy is now at $88 million total and should get to $100 million. And at number six, the movie I saw this weekend, Piranha 3D, which grossed $10 million on a $24 million budget and was awesome. And Nanny McPhee Returns was Emma Thompson's second film in a franchise, which grossed $8 million. Very soft, but it's already grossed about $60 million in the UK and the rest of the world. So they're already in the black. At number eight was the big news, the Jennifer Aniston film The Switch, which also stars Jason Bateman, and it grossed a pretty weak $8 million. And number nine, Inception, that's at $261 million. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World is dropping quickly, unfortunately, because it's very cool. That grossed $5 million and is at $20 million total. And at the bottom of number 11 was Despicable Me. So I saw Piranha 3D. I did my part to hold up the box office this weekend. What did you guys do?
Well, how much did you pay for Piranha 3D? How much were you holding it up?
Well, I'm in New York, so unfortunately I had to pay, you know, it was $18, including the 3D glasses.
Aww.
Sony AMC, the AMC 25 in Times Square, which there was a report a week and a half ago about bed bugs in that theater. So
ew.
That was a little, yeah, that was upsetting. But it was.
So the movie was cool?
It was not a good movie. I had a friend who worked on it. He was a still photographer, Gene Page. So I was very excited to see it. And it had actually gotten some very friendly reviews for what the type of movie it is. And the director said, oh, it's Gremlins for adults. I got kind of excited. I went to see it. It's just a dumb movie where, you know, girls in bikinis and guys get chomped up by piranhas. The piranhas weren't very good. The 3D was silly. But there were some good actors in it, including Elizabeth Shue and Christopher Lloyd, Richard Dreyfuss in a cameo, and Stephen R. McQueen, who is the grandson of Steve McQueen, which I didn't even realize. He's been on the TV show The Vampire Diaries, and he was the male lead, and it had a nice sense of humor.
10 Things I Hate About You, isn't he? Or is that a different McQueen? No, he's sexy.
Did he make it all the way through the film?
Well, he's the lead of the film, so you can guess that he'll probably stick around at least to the finale. But
Scott was the male lead in this film.
No, I mean, Jerry O'Connell has a big role. He's got a very funny role as a sort of Girls Gone Wild director who's there to shoot a video. So they have excuses to show lots of, you know, women in bikinis in the movie. But no, Stephen R. McQueen is the lead, Jake Forrester. And his mom is Elizabeth Shue, who's hot as a sheriff. And Ving Rhames is in there. I mean, there's a lot of good actors in it.
It's what happened to Elizabeth Shue's career?
Did she really ever have one? I mean, she started...
She was nominated for an Oscar. Yeah, she
even Las Vegas.
Yeah, and when was that movie made? 1996.
That's my point. I mean, what happened to her career?
I don't know that she ever really had one. I mean, I worked with her when she was...
Adventures in Babysitting?
Well, okay.
Karate Kid?
Okay, I was going to say, I worked with her right after The Karate Kid and Adventures in Babysitting, and then I kind of didn't hear from her for years, probably about 5 years, and then she... turned up with Nicolas Cage in Leaving Las Vegas, and that was pretty much it. I saw her in one or two other movies since then, and frankly, haven't seen much from her since.
Well, she did a Steven Soderbergh film called Underneath, which didn't do very well. Then Leaving Las Vegas, a very clever B-movie called The Trigger Effect, which is well worth renting. She was in a franchise, The Saint, with Alec Baldwin. That didn't work out well. She was in a Woody Allen movie, Deconstructing Harry.
Wait, The Saint was Val Kilmer. She was really good in that, yeah.
Oh, The Saint was Val... Oh, I'm sorry, which one was... The Shadow was Alec Baldwin. The Saint was Val Kilmer. You're right. Neither one of them did well, but...
No, The Saint's a fun movie.
Oh, it's not good, though.
Oh, no, it doesn't matter, though. It's still a good movie.
Yeah, so she just did the voiceover in Tuck Everlasting, a very good indie film, Mysterious Skin, my favorite film of 2004, a Greg Araki movie. But yeah, Dreamer, inspired by a true story, a family film, Hamlet 2, that movie that was hopefully going to do well that didn't. So she's been working. She was on Curb Your Enthusiasm a little, you know, two episodes of that. So she's been working pretty regularly and with pretty good people, but has not been in a movie that's really even remotely kept her profile the way it should be. And that's why she's in Piranha 3D, I guess.
Well, Piranha 3D, the 3D part of it actually helped that film because 90% of its box office gross came from 3D screens.
Yeah, but here's a question I bet you can't answer. How many screens was it on in 2D? Because I didn't see it anywhere in 2D. So if all the screens are 3D, it's not surprising that most of the grosses would come on 3D.
I don't know. I wish they would actually put that in, whether it's Hollywood.com or RentTrack. I'm sure that I could find this out, and I'll try and start doing that in the future on these 3D films, but I can't answer that question right now off the cuff.
Yeah, so if 90% of the screens are 3D, it's not surprising that most of the revenue would come from 3D. But really, it's a movie, you know, why would you want to see it except in 3D? Though I have to say, the piranhas weren't very scary, and the 3D was just very goofy and silly.
Yeah, no more talk about 3D. We talk about it every week. Can we put a moratorium on 3D chat?
Nope.
When you'll find out why later in this episode.
I saw the Kids Are All Right. Definitely not a 3D movie.
No.
Oh, what did you think?
You know, I was really disappointed in it. I'm sort of surprised that this is doing well because it had good performances and it's provocative subject matter and that it's about a lesbian couple raising children. But other than that, I thought this was very amateur.
Yeah, I have to agree. I found it very sitcom-y and not a good sitcom. It felt very predictable, except for the actors. There was very nothing interesting about it.
Well, the actors are Annette Bening plays one of the lesbians, and
Julianne Moore and Mark Ruffalo and Mia, whatever her last name is, from Alice in Wonderland, and
Josh Hutcherson.
Josh Hutcherson, yeah, who was supposedly up for Spider-Man. The performances are good. It's just I don't think that Lisa Cholodenko, who is the director, is very, very talented.
Well, you know, I enjoyed High Art. I'm not so sure about Laurel Canyon, which I think was her follow-up to that. But and as far as The Kids Are All Right, I saw it at Sundance, and I thought, you know, it was an okay film. I thought maybe they paid a little bit too much for it. I believe Fox Searchlight, or was it Focus, paid $5 million for that film.
Well, they made their money back.
They made their money back. And you know who's making their money back? Sylvester Stallone and Lionsgate with The Expendables. Who would have thought that after dropping 52% that Sylvester Stallone would have a movie that finished first at the box office, not 1 week in August, but 2 weeks during the summer?
Which is the first time since Cliffhanger, I think, for him, right?
I will have to take your word on that.
Yeah, we're going to trust you on that. Now, that really surprised me.
Well, something else that's surprising is the fact that this Vampire Suck movie was even released. I had no idea that it was even being released. That should tell you something. Now, mind you, I've been a little busy this summer, but still, Fox releases this film a month before it gets released. It is leaked onto the internet, and it's downloaded 100,000 times. So if I had known that, I would have been able to tell you, hey, I think this one might actually do well because people are interested in it.
That's your bizarre argument yet again, that if people see it for free, they'll actually want to see it again.
No, that's my bizarre argument for figuring out whether people are aware of the film or not.
No, I would agree with Sperling. I know it's counterintuitive, but I think he's got a point there.
I'm a little surprised that Nanny McPhee didn't do better, the second film in that franchise based on a popular children's series or a children's book series. The first one did quite well on DVD and in the theaters, and I just thought that maybe families would turn up a little bit.
No, but let's face it, the big story this week is the Switch at number 8.
Ugh, I know. Well, Eat, Pray, Love dropped 48%, so that was kind of a...
That doesn't surprise me, though.
Right, and the studio Sony was hoping that it would be a lot like another film it released last year that was geared towards women, Julie and Julia, but that film dropped less than 40%. Now, The Switch opened, as you mentioned, Karen, to disappointing numbers, and you too, Michael, mentioned that it was somewhat disappointing, and everybody's talking about Jennifer Aniston and whether she's a movie star or not. Earlier this year, her movie Bounty Hunter opened to $20.7 million, and then The Breakup, which was a 2006 film, premiered to $39.2 million.
And Marley and Me, in the midst of that, in 2008, opened to $36 million.
Yeah, but that wasn't her movie. That was the dog's movie.
No, she was still you're in it, baby. He's just not that into you. That wasn't her movie, right? That was more of an ensemble.
Right.
So that's $27 million opener. So if you're going to suddenly look at one or two movies and go, well, Love Happens was opened poorly in The Switch. Oh my gosh, she's not a movie star anymore. Well, it's not true. People clearly come to her movies when they open a time and again.
Oh, I totally disagree. I thought Patrick Goldstein made a very good point.
And Patrick Goldstein is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He was on our program, I think, 2 weeks ago it was, and we mentioned him at least once during every episode. He is quite the prolific columnist. And he says, and I'm quoting him, "When it comes to enduring mysteries, it's hard to come up with something more mystifying than how Jennifer Aniston became a movie star. After all, she's made an almost unbroken string of forgettable movies that have rarely made a lot of money, a streak that looks like it will remain intact with the release of The Switch this weekend." So he was writing this last week. He then goes on to credit a theory from one of his favorite sports columnists, Bill Simmons, over at ESPN, and being a sports guy, Simmons compares Aniston to an aging athlete like Karl Malone or Steve Nash, who has never won a championship ring and is desperate to finally get into the winner's circle.
But it's true. I mean, and the reason why women like her so much is because of the Brad and Angelina and Jennifer Aniston love triangle. You know, she's constantly cast as the person who was wronged, and she sort of embodies women who are, you know, pushing 40 and are divorced and never had babies and, you know, all that sexist stuff that people think women want. And it has made her career that much more successful. I mean, not successful, actually. He does say that, I think, but that's not really the case. It's why she continues to have a movie career.
Well, now, mind you, again, it's not him saying it. It's Bill Simmons of ESPN.
That's what I mean when I say him.
Okay, yeah. And Simmons said, "The saga evolved in various forms. The betrayal itself, the aftermath, when Aniston licked her wounds as Brangelina took off, her futile search for a bounce-back boyfriend, the Brangelina clan expanding, everyone feeling worse and worse for Aniston with her finally admitting that she was still bummed out, the Brangelina clan expanding again, Aniston's weird dalliance with the much younger John Mayer, which ended when he talked out of school about her, the Brangelina clan expanding yet again, Aniston approaching her 40th birthday and wanting a baby, the Brangelina clan producing twins, Aniston hitting 40 with no baby or husband, Aniston passing 40, and he goes on and on and on.
But it's because she's more famous in the tabloids.
No, it's because she's a very appealing personality who starred in one of the biggest hits of all time, Friends. She's a huge worldwide following for that. Her movies have grossed $1.7 billion around the world. I can name, here we go. She's got four or five movies that have grossed over $100 million, one over $200 million. She hasn't made a lot of good movies, but she's a very talented actress. I don't think the puzzle is why does Hollywood still back her. The puzzle is why she hasn't been able to pick better movies. But as my friend Joe Newmar, he's the critic at the New York Daily News, he said in an interview with Pop Eaters, when she picks stuff against the grain, she's actually quite good, like The Good Girl and Office Space.
That was so long ago, though. That's what's so interesting.
It was, but she needs to keep making smart picks like that. You know, she needs
Well, no kidding, but now she's trapped in this land of being caught up in her own celebrity. in
She's not. In He's just not the Itchy almost grossed $100 million. Marley and Me grossed $143 million. The breakup grossed $118 million. That's all in the last 4 years.
Well, if celebrity meant that your films would do better or not do well, I mean, then we would all be watching Paris Hilton movies. I kind of agree with what one commenter wrote on Patrick Goldstein's piece. Aniston is simply reflective of the state of the movie business itself. Marginal, limited, unoriginal, and cookie cutter.
I disagree. I think her movies have been like that, certainly, but I think she is very talented. I think she really, you know, of course, part of your talent is choosing the right script, and she clearly does not have that gift. But I do think she's a talented actress and very appealing. And in the old days, they probably would have built good vehicles for her, you know, back in the 40s.
Well, speaking of good vehicles and good writing, The Social Network has been getting all of this early buzz. And it started with the trailer, the teaser trailer that was released, I guess, 6 weeks ago for this film. Aaron Sorkin wrote the script. David Fincher directs it. Jesse Eisenberg stars as Mark Zuckerberg. And it tells the story of how Facebook was founded and all of the infighting that occurred during the founding and rise of Facebook, one of the world, probably the world's most successful and popular social networking tool. I guess now the question is it fact or is it fiction? There's some debate about that.
Well, is it literally Facebook or is it just a Facebook-like thing?
No, it is Facebook. I mean, Jesse Eisenberg is playing
Mark Zuckerberg,
right.
Yeah.
You know, it's getting good reviews. Scott Fondas from Film Comment let a review of the film go a little early, and he gave it a good review. And Peter Travers of Rolling Stone wrote, quote, "David Fincher's Social Network is the first film I've given 4 stars to in 2010. It's the movie of the year that also brilliantly defines the decade." Can you define a decade in the first year of the decade? Is that even possible?
I think it's the second year of the decade, it is the first year of the decade, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he means it defines the last decade.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, Scott Fondas got a lot of grief because he broke the quote-unquote embargo there because he's...
It's not quote-unquote embargo. It's an embargo.
Right. I don't think it was him that broke it. I think it was, he turned in his review and
His website broke it.
Right.
And that's wrong.
And he saw the film early because he is the head programmer for the New York Film Festival, and that film is opening the film festival, or is it closing the film festival? I can't remember. But it's certainly appearing there.
Yeah, I don't care about embargoes. That's going to be a thing of the past, I think, right, pretty soon anyway. What I find more appealing about this story is just the infighting, I guess, for the producers and Facebook and what's going to happen there, I find really interesting.
Yeah, there was an article in the New York Times titled "Facebook Feels Unfriendly Toward Film It Inspired," and it goes on to talk about how publicly Facebook is taking this stance that they're ignoring the film. And no matter what, they're just not going to acknowledge it. But behind the scenes, Mark Zuckerberg and all of his colleagues at Facebook have been locked in this standoff with filmmakers who portray Facebook as founded on a series of lies and betrayals. And they don't agree with that. They feel that the film is fiction.
I find that fascinating, but I'm definitely going to see this movie, not because I particularly care whether it's true or not. It's just that I think it's an interesting statement about, and it says this in one of the articles about, it's a commentary on our generation or something, emptiness?
Actually, I believe it was Scott Rudin who was being quoted by the New York Times. He said, it's a big story, it's a big American story that needs to be told.
Yeah, and it's such an example of how the geeks are really becoming the people that you want to be friends with and you want to be,
right,
really. Because they're the ones that are succeeding. That, to me, is much more interesting, you know, especially since I went to my high school reunion, a few months ago, and all the geeks are just phenomenally successful. And a lot of them are doing technology, and I love that.
Yeah, the geeks are the rock stars of this decade, yeah, for sure. And the film was written by Aaron Sorkin, based on a book by Ben Mezrich, who also wrote 21.
Right. I'd like to know, if it's all a bunch of lies, why haven't they sued Ben Mezrich?
Well, it's not a bunch of lies. It's right. All based on court documents.
And depositions, yeah.
Right, yeah, that's what I'm saying. So it's a bunch of bull from them. So, you know, put up or shut up. If it's a bunch of lies, sue the guy. If not, stop your belly aching and be quiet.
I think they've said they took a little bit of creative license here and there.
Yeah, blah, blah,
but,
blah.
But for the most part, like, all the facts are facts.
Right. Well, then Facebook says no. They say it's all. I mean, this one guy, David Kirkpatrick, said it's horribly, horrifically unfair, end quote.
But that's because David Kirkpatrick wants to sell his own book.
Right.
Facebook effect.
He wrote, yeah, right. He wrote a book, as you said, Karen, The Facebook Effect, which is a quote unquote reported account of the company's history. And he says, you know, much of the film is complete fiction.
And the idea that this movie has Oscar buzz is malarkey too. You know, two people have you know, leaked early comments about it. All right, fine.
Yeah, but so, look at who's involved. Scott Rudin.
No. Yeah, I'm saying in general.
Aaron Sorkin wrote it. That's Oscar bait. You can tell already.
Oh, it's Oscar bait, but the fact that they're, you know, oh, it's got Oscar buzz. Come on, you know, wait till the movie's actually even reviewed by more than two people. Yes, well, it's Oscar potential.
That's just people using the wrong word.
Well, right. I'm actually thinking of writing a post for Celluloid Junkie on how this film is being marketed, not by those that are paid to do so, i.e. the publicists and the promotional team behind the film, but in fact, by the geeks themselves. They're creating these kind of satires of the trailer. One was called the Twitter movie or the Twitter story.
Oh, that is so funny. Have you seen that?
Yeah. I mean, there are all these little send-ups of the trailer.
Hashtags.
We saw the mashup for the trailer of Inception and Inception and Up. That was clever. I mean, people generate their own content online, and it's only going to work with a movie that either they're interested in or has a good trailer to begin with. So I think it's perfectly natural. I don't think it's a wildly promotional thing that, you know, it just shows people are paying attention. You know how I'd be more excited to see this movie? If only they had cast Jennifer Aniston.
Oh, God. See, that would so keep me out of the theaters. I can't stand her.
Ah, here we go. Now comes the truth. There's no reason not to stand her. Because she makes bad movies? Or you don't like her?
She's whiny and
she barely talks. She doesn't say anything whiny. She doesn't go complaining about
it. She doesn't have to. She pretends to take the high road.
Well, the Twitter effect and all these mock trailers, of course, they get all of their play on YouTube. And I find myself spending a lot more time carousing. I don't know. I'm sick. You know, give me a break.
Causing mayhem on YouTube?
Yeah, just watching YouTube. I don't watch it on television as much as I could because I have a TiVo. But I know, Michael, you've highlighted a couple of stories here, both of which are from the New York Times, that talk about television and the web and the living room and how they're all merging.
Well, the New York Times had a series of stories called The Sofa Wars. And one was about people potentially cutting off their cable just to go online and watch movies via the internet. One was about, I'm sorry to say it, Karen, but 3D television sets and how manufacturers are convinced that'll be the future. And a couple other stories about television and the fight for people's eyeballs. And the attempt to do a whole Apple TV type thing where you become the person to bring content to their TV from the computer or from online. And it was actually, it was a good packaging of three different stories. Probably the most interesting was about being hooked on pay TV and how the idea of cord cutting, that you would get rid of your cable or satellite subscription and just go pure online, has really not happened yet. They looked at a bunch of different surveys and trends and polling and actual subscriptions to cable and satellite. And even in the economic downturn, satellite and cable TV subscriptions continue to grow. People are simply not cutting it away. Yes, young people think about it more than older people, but they talked in the article to young people who tried to cut off and they couldn't do it because they want to watch True Blood. They want to watch American Idol, whatever they, you know, there's a lot of shows that aren't available online. And so as tempting as it is to talk about cutting the cord, people are not doing it that very much because cable TV is too convenient and too good a deal. You cannot substitute it with Hulu and YouTube. It just doesn't work yet. It might someday, and people are trying for it. One person said 88% of respondents paid for traditional TV service. This is a New York Times CBS News poll this month. Just 15% of those people had considered replacing their service with internet video like Hulu and YouTube. Younger people are more intrigued. People under 45 were significantly more likely than older ones to say they'd thought about it. They found that people under 45 were four times as likely as those to say they could replace cable someday down the road. Nonetheless, cable and satellite TV subscriptions continue to grow. That's the basic thing here. No matter what people say is a trend, people are still doing it.
I don't think that people starting to watch TV online is going to be a matter so much of converting people. It's going to be a generational thing. So more and more people will do it simply because the younger generations will start to do it and start to consider that to be the norm.
Well, that's the whole point of the article. The idea is that they spoke to young people and they get out of college and they get their cable and satellite TV because they want to watch sports, they want to watch True Blood, and they can't do it. They thought about it.
Eventually they will, and as those offerings are become available online, generations, you know, below us and below them and below them will consider that to be the norm. That's how people are going to start watching TV online. It's because it's going to be there. And they're so used to living their entire lives online, that's going to be where they go to watch TV. I mean, that's how it's going to change.
Well, Craig Moffat, at a cable industry analyst at Bernstein, says you're right. He says entrepreneurs will, quote, keep storming the castle until somebody figures it out, you know, about the way to get people to have all the TV they want online without getting cable. But he also called cord cutting perhaps the most overhyped and overanticipated phenomenon in tech history, which itself is an overhype and an overstatement. But
I was going to say, when I read that, I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I can find a few more overhyped and overanticipated phenomenons in tech history. iPhone.
And the likely thing is, of course, not cord cutting, but cord slicing, maybe meaning people cut back on their pay-per-view and video on demand because they're using Netflix to stream movies and things like that. You know, they'll cut back on their cable bill while they slowly segue into the internet as more and more things become available. And if all your sports and American Idol and True Blood were available online, you're right. A lot more people would cut their cable thing. Why not?
Well, I found this whole story about TV makers predicting a bright future for 3D sets.
Ha!
Yeah, no duh. It's like, you know, that's like saying in the late 60s, early 70s, TV makers believe that they will sell more color television sets. No, kidding.
I'm laughing sarcastically.
Oh, okay. Well, that's going to happen. More 3D sets will sell than non-3D sets because television manufacturers are only focusing predominantly on 3D TV sets, because if you were a consumer buying a TV set, why would you buy one that was not 3D capable? Maybe not 3D ready, or maybe didn't have 3D out of the box, but why would you buy one that wasn't 3D?
Because it costs $1,000 more than your regular TV. That's why. There aren't $800,000, $1,200 flat screen TVs that have 3D capable.
Well, I think that's a short-lived upcharge, because a lot of the televisions that were sold before this big 3D craze are 3D capable with a software upgrade, because the technology to do 3D television, yes, there is some technology there, but it's not as drastic as everybody thinks. A lot of these flat screen television sets are already 3D capable. People just don't know it yet.
But I know we've talked about this all the time. I just don't think people want to sit in their living rooms with their 3D glasses on. I think they're more willing to do it in the movie theater because that's an experience.
Yep. Right now, according to the New York Times, right now, 3D televisions cost $1,200 more than the equivalent flat panel 2D televisions. Oh, I'm sorry, when averaged across all sizes. They say by 2014, they'll only cost $300 more than regular TV.
Sorry, no way. Uh-uh. I could get a used iPad for that. No way.
And that doesn't include a lot of hidden costs. Sony and Samsung right now charge $150 for each pair of 3D glasses, and a new TV set doesn't come with a pair. Glasses from different television brands are not compatible. You also need a 3D Blu-ray player if you want to watch, you know, Blu-ray DVD. And so for a family of four, it's going to cost at least $800 more. And that for $800, you can get a good plasma TV.
Well, and I can tell you those glasses do not cost $800 to manufacture. So
they didn't say $800. They said the total cost. You got four people in your family. That's $600 right there, plus a Blu-ray player. That alone is $800.
Well, much like movie theaters are falling in love with 3D films because they get to upcharge and raise the price of a movie ticket by $3 or $4, television manufacturers, electronics manufacturers, and those that release content, like Disney, who will have a plethora of 3D content with all of their Pixar releases, they're going to be the ones pushing for this because they can charge more and earn more. And of course, I mean, if you're Sony and you're manufacturing a pair of 3D glasses for $12 and selling them for $150, you're going to push that.
Well, you're an idiot, because you're not going to sell your TV, which you can make a big profit on, because you make the glasses too expensive. Because they had a mention, they went to Costco where they were demonstrating 3D TV, and the reporter said the glasses there were cracked and broken and falling apart, which certainly doesn't, you know, hey, great, you pay $150 for a glass and you got to buy another pair 6 months later. That's a huge amount of money, and I'm with Karen. TV is a communal experience. You sit around, you look, you talk, you laugh. you watch a lot more TV than you do a movie. You watch 3-4 hours a night, and you're not going to want to sit there with those glasses on that whole time. But anyway.
Well, would you watch American Idol in 3D?
No.
Not even if Steven Tyler were a judge?
Oh, his lips could come right out.
Especially not if Steven
Tyler.
No,
his lips could come right out into your living room. It would be exciting. Okay, I would watch that.
Steven Tyler, lead singer of Aerosmith, who last year fell off a stage and I think broke his shoulder or his ankle, or he broke something. And Aerosmith kind of was on tour, and they had to go off tour because he was injured and then went into rehab. It turns out that the bass player for Aerosmith was doing an interview with the New Jersey Star-Ledger, my old stomping grounds. And his name is Tom Hamilton, the bassist, and he said that Steven Tyler was definitely heading to Idol. Quote, "Steven is doing American Idol. The ink is dry on that," he said. Quote, "So we'll have to work around his schedule for a new record. I'm surprised that these guys are even doing a new record, because apparently Steven Tyler and Joe Perry are in this huge argument, and Joe Perry is the lead guitarist for Aerosmith. Last week, Joe Perry knocked Steven Tyler off stage in Toronto, and a week before that, Steven Tyler accidentally, it looks like, hit Joe Perry over the head with a mic stand."
Okay, but the pushing him off the stage, that was an accident too. And
did you see it?
And Steven, yeah, I saw it. It totally was an accident. And Steven Tyler and Joe Perry have been fighting for years.
20 years, yeah. It's no news.
Oh, okay.
But more importantly,
Sperling, go back and watch that. That was an accident.
What do you think of the choice, Karen?
I think it's a great choice. I really do.
I don't.
Yeah, I do. At first I didn't, but giving a little bit more thought to it, I think there's potential there for him to be really a rather interesting judge. I think he's going to be the Paula, not the Simon. I think he'll be entertaining.
I mean, I haven't seen enough interviews, I guess, with him to know what he's like. But I mean, he could be crazy, nutty, wacky Paula. You're right. But it doesn't strike me as a very, now you're just hoping he'll be entertaining as opposed to actually a good judge that provides cogent, analysis of the kids and helps them along and is a good person.
If he can, that would do really interesting things to his career. If he can't, it's not going to hurt him.
No, it's not a bad choice for him. Why not? He'll make $10 million or whatever and he can walk away.
I think that Steven Tyler and Jennifer Lopez as judges would change the show, but not necessarily in a bad way, because the show is so stagnant right now anyway. It needs a jump start of some kind, and I think they thought they were doing that with Ellen, but it would really be a different show with J-Lo and Steven Tyler, and not necessarily in a bad way.
And Jennifer Lopez, it's only rumored that she's working right. her way toward being a judge, but Fox is neither confirming nor denying any of this.
Yeah, no, I think she would be an awful judge, but they say that, I think it was Nigel Lithgow, the former and now
current.
You again, current, yeah, producer, has said they want to focus more on teaching them performance and how to, getting makeovers and, how important that is. And so maybe they're bringing her in for that.
Well, no, they're basically trying to mimic the format of the X Factor, which spends a lot more with the judges actually mentor contestants, work with them, help them pick the songs, and a lot of the show is backstage stuff with them.
Yeah, but
fighting
they can't do that with these judges. They can't mimic the X Factor with American Idol because Simon Cowell will sue them.
That's what they're doing when they can show them getting makeovers. They can do whatever they want.
Yeah, but that has nothing to do with judges.
They don't own that. They don't own the rights to that.
They already do that on American Idol. But if they can't, my point was that they can't bring Jennifer Lopez on to critique people's voice. I mean, that's just a joke. I mean, she obviously would, but that's just a joke. But if they want to focus more on teaching people how to be good performers, then she's one of the best. She could certainly critique that.
Well, I guess they do have to change the show. It's been 10 years and it's, it's crazy and all that. But it'll be a show about the judges instead of the contestants. And that's not what American Idol was. But there are wild cards and we won't know until they get on stage and the camera turns on.
No, and you're absolutely right, especially because Nigel Lithgow said he wanted to make it about the contestants again. So that does seem like a strange choice.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of American Idol contestants, a week or so ago we had a story about Fantasia Barrino, who was a contestant on American Idol several years ago.
Didn't she?
And she won. Yes, indeed.
I know my pop culture, huh?
Michael, do you want to explain what happened with her?
Well, we had talked about this last week. The story we had was that Fantasia Barrino attempted suicide and her people tried to cover it up and say, no, she was just tired. Now she's come clean and said, yes, I did attempt suicide. Come on, you can't take a whole bottle of pills by accident. And what bothered us about the story last week was that she attempted suicide somewhere around August 10th And then just a week later, she's back in the mill, you know, pushing her new album because the machine is rolling. You got to keep it going. And they're saying, oh, this is what she wants to do. And it just seemed, you know, can this really be the best thing for her mental health and for her long-term future to jump right back into publicity? But here she is, and she's back in the mill, and she was on VH1 doing a new Behind the Music. And she talked about her attempted suicide. She said, I didn't have any fight in me. I didn't care about anything. I just wanted out. At that moment, I wanted out. I wanted it to be over with all of it, all of that blank. I just sat in the closet and looked at the mirror and took all the pills in the bottle. I wanted to go to sleep and just be at peace. I knew exactly what I was doing. And I appreciate her honesty, but that disturbs me even more now that we know for certain that she did attempt suicide, that all her people around her think the best thing for her to do is jump right back into the middle of pushing a new album. It just, it bothers me.
What bothers me about her, I mean, I think it's good that she was honest, but it upsets me because of other kids that are thinking about doing the same thing. And she's almost given them the okay in a weird kind of way.
Well, I don't know if you saw the rest of this story, but she does talk about how it was a stupid move. And
she did? Okay, yeah. I didn't finish reading the story then.
And how a nurse that she met in the hospital actually helped her emotionally get back on her feet. Now, mind you, this all happened in the matter of 2 days.
but no, I don't think anyone, unless she recklessly says, oh my God, it was fun to attempt suicide. I don't think anyone being honest about dealing with any demons or drug or alcohol or suicide or depression encourages people by talking about it. I think it helps other people. Hopefully, if anything, it encourages people to talk about it and their desire or need for it.
Well, now, you know who might be a good judge on American Idol? Lil Wayne. Except to be a judge on American Idol, he'd probably have to take a pay cut because of course, he'd have to get out of prison, which is where he is right now. He's in prison.
Yeah, that's really the big obstacle.
Yeah, well, during his first 5 months at Rikers Island, where he is,
I was going to say American Idol, Rikers Island edition.
Yeah. During his first 5 months there, he has released at least 23 tracks featuring guest appearances. I should say other artists have released those tracks featuring guest appearances by him, including a remix of Drake's and Jay-Z's collaboration "Light Up," for which Wayne contributed verses by phone from jail. And by Forbes estimates, he's actually earned more money this year in prison, $20 million, than last year, in which he earned $18 million, in part thanks to a plan he cooked up in the months before his incarceration. He and his team cooked up this whole marketing plan to release music while he was in prison.
Well, they didn't marketing plan. They just said, let's just bank as many songs as we can before you got to go to jail.
It's pretty amazing.
That was the plan. I mean, they just said, let's bank as much music as we can so that we can keep this stuff coming while you're locked up. I don't know if it's exactly genius. It's just, you know, let's record what we can.
Well, now see, imagine if he could get Suge Knight to bump him off. Think how rich he'd be then.
Yeah. You know, if that's the case, you know, he'd really have to plan way ahead for that, don't you
think?
Yeah,
you'd have to record a lot more.
Well, during the run-up to his time in jail, he ran around with a mobile studio so that he could record all the time. And in one 48-hour period over the Super Bowl weekend in February, Wayne shot 9 music videos.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean,
not very elaborate ones, I imagine.
No, and some of them were for songs that nobody had even heard of. They were like listening to the music on his Mac, and they shot it against a green screen so that later when the music was finished, they could drop him into the video. So they actually had a lot of plans for him while he was away.
Well, so, I mean, if you just stood in front of a video screen and you know, lip-sync to a song, that's not exactly shooting a music video. That's just sort of doing a low-rent prep work so you can slap anything behind him.
Well, last week we spoke about digital music and digital downloads, and this week EMI, the record company, says digital music is overinflated and too reliant on iTunes. In their filing with the SEC, they said that, quote, as a result of the global economic slowdown and the uncertainty in general, reduction to the current market estimates of the growth of the digital and online music markets, and the continuing rapid decline of the physical market, the directors have concluded, and these are EMI's directors, have concluded there was sufficient doubt over the recoverability of the carrying value of certain intangible assets to warrant an impairment review of the music catalogs.
Huh?
That's legalese and financial legalese to say, we're taking a big, huge write-down. And they took a write-off of £602 million.
It's about $1 billion.
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah, well, 2 to 1. Yeah, it's like more like 1.4 to 1, but yeah.
Yeah, so that would be $900 million.
But EMI Music is saying that they continue to face challenges by the over decline in physical sales, and that digital sales have not caught up yet.
Well, they're right, and they're right about, you know, trying to encourage Amazon.com and other outlets selling digital music as well. It's healthier for everyone.
Yeah, they say that the industry must wean itself off of the iTunes store, that particular distribution channel and way of selling digital media is too dominant and too prevalent.
They must wean themselves off the teat of iTunes.
Yeah.
On that note, I guess we should probably move on to our lightning round, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we discuss the week's top entertainment news stories and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. What do you say?
Let's do it.
I say, let's do it.
Hey, if Facebook can get a movie, why not Google? That's the thinking behind Hollywood's optioning of the Ken Oletta book, Google, The End of the World as We Know It. Will Do No Evil be as compelling as Facebook's tale of backbiting and betrayal? And what's next? Hulu, the movie? Karen, is a Google movie a big deal or a big whoop? You can search for that answer if you'd like.
You mean Google that answer?
Yeah,
that was sorry, same thing.
Big deal. I can't imagine a more boring movie. There is no drama that I'm aware of behind Google.
So you mean big whoop?
I always do that, don't I?
No, yeah, this is a big whoop. Are confused.
It'd be more interesting now. I'd be more interested now to see what they talk about behind the scenes, but I don't care about Google's origins.
I think it's a big whoop. It should be a documentary and cost like $1 million or $2 million to make.
Well, having read the book by Ken Oletta, it is a fascinating book. And I thought, oh, this will be, you know, kind of a dry read. It is. He does such a good job in that book. It's well worth reading. It's very interesting and incredibly engaging. And you're right.
Really?
As a documentary, it would be very interesting. Anyway, how do you say The Office in Cantonese? Someone's going to have to find out, because the TV sitcom The Office, which began in the UK and has been adapted for local markets in the US and all over the world, is now coming to China. It's a long-running trend of creating local versions of hit TV shows, whether they're game shows or reality shows like American Idol, or sitcoms and dramas like Ugly Betty. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Hi! It's a big deal. Not because The Office is making a movie in China, because I think that's only natural, but the growth of China as a market for entertainment products, you know, movies and music and TV is starting to get in there, and that's going to just be a huge market over down the road.
I think it's been a huge market for an awfully long time. I'm actually more interested in China coming here and us taking their comics, their television shows. I can't think of any TV shows we've taken, but they're a lot of the, you know, the comic books and cultures, that stuff's much more interesting, I think.
He won't make The Hobbit, but he might make Hellboy 3. That's the word from director Guillermo del Toro, who told MTV News he'd love to do it, but the main stumbling block is star Ron Perlman's aversion to the makeup. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, big whoop. Put your big boy pants on, buddy. Put that makeup on.
Michael?
A big whoop, and for God's sakes, Ron Perlman, what else are you doing?
Shia LaBeouf has not been kicked off the next Indiana Jones movie. When LaBeouf spoke out and said Indy 4 sucked, it was possible director Steven Spielberg might have said, it doesn't suck, you suck. Instead, LaBeouf says he was called in to hear the pitch, the concept behind the next episode, and it's crazy, he said. Spielberg and Lucas and Harrison Ford have all signed off on the idea and want to make a movie sooner rather than later. I wonder why. Could it be because they're aging? But first, someone's going to have to start writing the script. Michael, do you have a pen? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, I could so write a good script for them. It's a big deal. It's a big franchise. They need to get it done before Harrison turns 70.
Karen?
Yeah, I agree. Same reason. They need to do it before Harrison dies.
Zac Efron refused to cut loose, footloose, on the film adaptation of the Kevin Bacon classic. Is that the right word? Footloose. But now...
Yeah, so that's a classic.
Okay, well, but now he's eyeing another big screen musical. It's Memphis, a feature film to be directed by, potentially, Oliver Stone, who's wanted to make a musical since he failed to snag Evita. This film is about a DJ who falls in love with a black female singer. But Efron has some competition for the role. Justin Timberlake. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal in a sense because it's been a long time since I thought of a Broadway show. And this is obviously the Broadway Tony-winning musical Memphis that they're talking about being turned into a feature film. That's so, it's a big deal.
Karen?
Big whoop. Man may get job. Big deal. Big whoop.
My God, Conan O'Brien thinks he's Sammy Davis Jr. O'Brien is releasing two CDs on Jack White's label. One, thank God, is a comedy album built around Frankenstein. The other, a rockabilly album featuring O'Brien and his band, including a duet with Jack White of the White Stripes. Meanwhile, while O'Brien is goofing around, his writers are reportedly unhappy about the pay cut they're taking. The Writers Guild is still in negotiations about what pay rates are appropriate for his new show on TBS. So, Karen, is a room of unhappy writers a big deal or a big whoop, and will you buy either of Conan's albums?
No.
To both, or just to the albums?
To the albums, no, I won't. But I do think it's a big deal that he's doing the blue hillbilly bluegrass one, whichever one. I think that's kind of fun, actually. As to the writers, I mean, it's a big deal to them, but ultimately it's sort of a big whoop. I mean, we've talked about writers and how much they get paid quite a bit. Sorry, guys. Strike is over.
I won't buy the album. Someone will send them to me for free, I hope, from the PR people. And it's a big whoop for the writers. It's TBS, not HBO. How could you not expect a pay cut?
Neil Patrick Harris won his first Emmy. Then he won his second. Apparently, being gay does pay. Ooh, I rhymed. Harris won his first Emmys over the weekend in a ceremony held for the Emmy categories that don't make it to prime time. Harris won for hosting the Tonys and his guest spot on Glee. Maybe now he'll be a frontrunner for his long-running role as a womanizer, Barney, on How I Met Your Mother. Karen, is Doogie's first Emmys a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop. He deserves them.
Michael.
It's a big deal because he's out and he got them then. You know, his career's gotten bigger than ever since he came out. But I find it bizarre. Two other awards that were given out were John Lithgow for Dexter. I wish I'd seen this because he thanked HBO instead of Showtime. That must have been embarrassing. And Betty White won an Emmy for her appearance on Saturday Night Live. Why didn't they put the Betty White category in prime time so she could accept it on TV and everyone would see her? She's the most famous woman in the world. Bad choice on their part.
We teased Wyclef Jean about thinking the rules don't apply to him when he decided to run for president of Haiti, even though he hasn't been a resident of the country for the previous 5 years, as the law demands. Apparently, the top ruling body agreed and declared Jean ineligible. But he's not done yet. Jean called for calm, but is appealing the decision. Michael, is Jean's being disqualified a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal because the country's rife with corruption, and actually following the rules of law rather than just letting somebody take over the country is good.
Karen?
I agree. Big deal for the same reason.
Jersey Shore continues to be a smash hit for MTV. The latest episodes reached 5.5 million people and beat every major network in the coveted 18 to 34 demographic. And that means money. Mike Sorrentino, a.k.a. The Situation, stands to make some $5 million this year thanks to a workout video, an autobiography, vodka endorsements, a vitamin supplement line with GNC, personal appearance fees, and more. The Situation is cashing in. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Big whoop.
Michael?
It's a big deal for him. He got the right people because he should cash in because his time is slowly slipping away. Though I did hear a rumor that he will be on Dancing with the Stars next year. That was according to a UK newspaper, The Mail, I think.
Well, I just want to have my name have an article before it. Like, The Sperling.
The Sperling.
Yeah.
We'll start calling you that if you want.
Oh, yeah. No, that was a joke.
No, we will. Come on, The Sperling. Go
oh,
on.
Oh, I love that. The Sperling. That's pretty awesome.
Lady Gaga is the self-proclaimed queen of Twitter. She has 5.7 million followers, edging out Britney Spears, who was in a close battle there for a while. Gaga immediately released a goofy video celebrating her new status and waving a wand around. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop, and do you follow her on Twitter?
No, I don't follow her on Twitter, though I have been called a little monster by other people online. And it's a big deal because that new media way of reaching out to people matters.
Karen, do you follow Lady Gaga on Twitter?
I don't. I don't care about her. I think this is a big whoop because, what, a gazillion celebrities are on Twitter right now. Who cares?
Most ad buyers told Media Life magazine in a survey they believed American Idol would be number one for only one more season at most. That's right, thanks to competition from Simon Cowell's The X Factor next fall and the parade of judges out the door, they think Idol will fall from its number one perch. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I suppose that it is a big deal, but I personally think it's a big whoop because I think we all kind of saw this happening. I mean, shows have shelf lives.
Michael?
Thank you. It's a big whoop. It's the stupidest prediction ever. Any show that's number one, you can say it's not going to be number one for much longer. And this show's been number one for longer than any show in history. 6 years in a row. No one's ever done it. So of course it will fall off eventually.
Well, that brings us to our final segment, Inside Baseball, where we discuss only the news stories that people in Hollywood might care about. And this week, we're going to start off, Michael, you had a story you wanted to talk about.
I think you should start with the traffic.
Okay, well, the traffic is usually outside on the streets. And okay, you mean the traffic for Hollywood Reporter, which apparently is outpacing most of its rivals, including some mainstream rivals. The Hollywood Reporter, one of the two leading Hollywood trade papers, in July saw more than 1.9 million unique visitors. And that's according to third-party measurement companies, so they're not just saying that. It's ComScore and Media Metrics that's saying that. That is 61% higher than Deadline Hollywood, which had 1.18 million unique visitors. And it's four times as much traffic as their rival publication, Variety, got during the same time period. And not to mention, The Wrap is, I guess, getting, what, 370,000 unique visitors per month? So, and then you turn it over to some major brands and major media outlets like New York Post's Page Six, your stomping grounds, Michael, 1.8 million unique visitors. Rolling Stone got 1.24 million. Vanity Fair only got 967,000. And the Los Angeles Times, The Envelope, got 193,000. Now, with all fairness to the LA Times, The Envelope is just one section of their website.
Right, right. Just like the New York Post Page Six, that's a separate website.
Okay, so...
And for the record, while I wrote for the New York Post, I never contributed to Page Six.
Okay. which is an important distinction when you...
Yeah,
it is.
In addition, THR performed impressively in other key ComScore metrics. The average minutes per visitor were 2.9 minutes, which outclocked most other websites. The Wrap 2.2, Deadline Hollywood 1.2, and Variety had, I guess, 0.8 minutes per visitor.
I think the message is, if you and your competitors don't all go to a paywall at the same time, if you go alone, chances are your competitor's going to, you know, gain hugely on you. So it's very hard to do. I mean, the New York Times is going to go behind a paywall. If the LA Times and Chicago Tribune and Washington Post don't do it, God help them.
Well, do you think that Variety going behind a paywall, which is what you're referring to, that's the only reason that the Hollywood Reporter's numbers are up?
Well,
I don't think so.
Absolutely. I used to go to both of them. I used to even go to Variety more. Now I never go to Variety. Why would I? You can't read it.
Well, I would like to credit Andrew Wallenstein and maybe even Janice Min for putting a new face onto that media outlet. The Hollywood Reporter is what
I don't think we're seeing the difference in content really all that much.
Yeah, she just started there. I mean, I don't think she's really – you don't think – what has she done that you like?
She hired Kim Masters.
Well,
but Kim Masters is, you know, broke the story about Steve McPherson, but I'm for the most part not seeing a huge difference in content. I'm really not.
Well, I'm paying much more attention to their blogs now, and the blogs are being given much more prominence than they had been in the past.
Well, okay, that's interesting, but I think that I agree with Michael. The reason why the numbers are going up is because they took Varieties.
Now, you had a story, Michael, that I referred to originally. Do you want to talk about that story in relation to these numbers?
So the article I highlighted was about Lindsay Lohan, and it was in the Hollywood Reporter, but I wasn't really thinking about the source when I first read it. It's just about Lohan coming out and her being offered potentially $1 million for her first post-prison interview. And the article said she's in rehab, the deals are starting to come together for her comeback, not film deals, mind you, but interview and appearance deals. First up, she gets $1 million, perhaps, to do her first post-prison interview with OK Magazine. Then they talked about appearance fees that she would get and went on and on and on. And as I kept reading the article, I kept getting a little more confused. It talked about her film career, and it said things like, I'm wondering if this is part of the attempt to remake The Hollywood Reporter. The article had a very snarky attitude. It was very mocking. There was no news in it. In fact, the claim that she was being offered $1 million for OK Magazine didn't have any source or reference. I don't even know if it's true. I don't know what their source was for it, whether they got the, you know, there were no quotes from anyone. It was just the reporter sort of mouthing off like you will on a blog, which is fine. But, you know, they were talking about her film career, and they said things like, quote, her film career is shaping up to make Tara Reid's look like Sandra Bullock's.
Wow. Ouch.
Yeah. The Hollywood Reporter, the film parts she is lining up are, at best, delightfully fringe.
You know what? I think that's probably where Lindsay Lohan needs to go in terms of her career. She does need to do some really gritty fringe roles.
But they're not fringe. They also mockingly said that they hardly seem like Oscar-worthy movies. It's like, well, A, she's never made an Oscar-worthy movie, so why would that change? But the two movies she just they talked about, one is a Linda Lovelace biopic about the porn star turned Christian anti-porn activist. And it actually is a film that actually is sort of Oscar, you know, type movie. It's a role that could absolutely get her a lot of attention. I have no idea whether it'd be any good, but just as far as a product and a property, that's absolutely an Oscar type movie. Playing a real life person in a dramatic role like that, where she's going to be edgy.
Yeah, playing a slut. That's great.
Right. And then slut turned born again Christian activist. And then the
men who vote for Academy winners love that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And then the other film is Robert Rodriguez film Machete. And they made it sound like it's some sort of Roger Corman film that she'd be embarrassed to star in. It's like Roger Rodriguez makes very popular, successful movies with lots of big movie stars. That's not some B-level junky thing to be in. That's a perfectly good film credit, especially for her. That seems like a perfectly. No. So not only was I a little disturbed by the tone and attitude of the article and the fact that it was completely, you know, content free. It was just mouthing off like I do all day long. I just look for better stuff than that in the Hollywood Reporter. Not only that, but I feel like their analysis of the two movies they mentioned is completely off. It was written by Jay Fernandez and Leslie Bruce. It was very snarky.
Well, and those are two good reporters, actually.
Well, this isn't an example of it. And anyway, Las Vegas is a dangerous milieu given her addictions compared to what? Los Angeles? I mean, come on. So I don't know if you guys took the time to read the article or what you thought about it.
No, but this was not a blog, right?
No, this was a news article. Exactly.
Yeah, that surprises me. I mean, even the entertainment shows are starting to voice their opinions more and more often. Have you noticed on Access Hollywood, they now like banter back and forth by like what they think about certain news stories. So it doesn't surprise me that the Hollywood Reporter is starting to do that. I agree with you that it belongs in a blog, not in something that's trying to pass itself off as news. So that's a little offensive.
It's just hard to change the nature of a whole, you know, an outlet that you expect to be dispassionate and smart and informative to get attitudinal is a very tricky thing to do, I think.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's episode of Showbiz Sandbox. You can subscribe to our podcast in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, where we encourage you to rate and review the podcast. You can also subscribe to it by visiting our website, showbizsandbox.com, where you will find links to all the stories we've discussed in today's episode. Our website is also where you'll find links to our social networking accounts, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, as well as ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Karen Woodward can be found on her website, karenwoodwardonline.com, or on Twitter, @Karen_Woodward. Michael Giltz is on Twitter, and his username is @MichaelGiltz, and all of his writing for all of his various outlets can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com, or on the Huffington Post. Some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. My Twitter username is @Sperling. Until next week, play nice. Shia LaBeouf has not been kicked off the next Indiana Jones movie. When LaBeouf spoke out and said Indy 4 sucked, it was possible director Steven Spielberg might have said it doesn't suck.
Wait, cut. First of all, Shia LaBeouf.
Spielberg.
Steven Spielberg.
The Borg have taken over director Steven Spielberg. The Borg directive. I don't know. Anyway.
Okay, I'll reread it.
Keep all this.
You gotta put that in the outtakes.